Hello, producer Abby here with a public service announcement for you just before you get into our exclusive chat with Phil Neville. We at The Offside Rule will be doing daily podcasts throughout the 2019 Women's World Cup. We're going to be joined by former Lionesses Siobhan Chamberlain, Gilly Flaherty and Claire Rafferty. Tough combo to say that one. And you can hear it all only on Spotify. You don't need a premium account, you just need the Spotify app. Make sure you're subscribed on Spotify so that you can follow your team throughout France, because it's not all about the Lionesses. Scotland are there too, and 22 other teams. Anyway, over to you, Kate.
The Offside Rule exclusives.
Phil Neville, synonymous with Manchester United, Everton and an England international, is the first high-profile former footballer and coach to bridge the gap between men's and women's football. In charge of the Lionesses before arguably their biggest test to date, myself, Kate Borsay and Hayley McQueen took the Offside Rule exclusives up to England's national training base as they prepare for the Women's World Cup.
The Offside Rule exclusives with Hayley McQueen and Kate Borsay.
Phil, thanks for joining us. We can't talk to you without talking about Manchester United and the anniversary of winning the treble. It's an exciting time for all Manchester United fans when they recollect back. What are your memories of that time when I throw that to you?
Well, I think if you think back to that time, people think about Ollie and Teddy's goals, but it was a 10-day process that started when we beat Tottenham in the league, and then we went to the FA Cup final and beat Newcastle, and then we obviously went to Barcelona. But it was actually the parties afterwards that you would probably remember more than the actual games. I mean, the game in Barcelona was a real poor game, probably our poorest performance of the season apart from the last 2 minutes. The FA Cup final seemed quite straightforward. And the celebrations after the league win were pretty big, because that was the start of the treble. It was the best 10 days of my life. I don't like looking back on things, but if I could rewind my life back to 10 days, it would be them. I mean, you think about beating Tottenham at home, then we're celebrating the league, then going down to Wembley in the FA Cup final, which was every kid's dream to play and was sandwiched in between, and I was fortunate enough to play in that. And then we went out to Barcelona on Concorde, which was a special treat for us. 2 minutes to go, they were celebrating next to us. The cup was dripped in Bayern Munich ribbons. And then we scored those two goals. And I've got to say, the celebrations afterwards was with the family on the open-top bus tour around Manchester was probably the best moment of my life.
It's been quite good, because I was part of a documentary. They came and asked me for my memories. I was only at college at the time, so not even working in football. So I was a proper fan then. And it was really great, because it gave me the chance to reminisce and really watch back on matches and things that perhaps I hadn't noticed at the time. Or as a journalist, you see things differently than being a fan. Do you see things differently now you look back?
Yeah. Well, I think when people ask, because it's the treble year, people have asked us, we've done a lot of interviews that treble team this year, and the things that you remember aren't the goals or the Ryan Giggs goal, say, in the semi-final. It's things like coming into the dressing room after the game in Turin and seeing Scholesy and Roy Keane disappointed because they've been booked and they can't play in the final. And then in the final, when my best moment of the final was when Roy and Henningberg and Paul came onto the pitch in the Blazers after game. We did this guard of honour for them, and they came on and took the celebrations. You know, the goals everyone knows about, but it was actually the things underneath. You know, seeing my brother get emotional on the pitch for the first time ever in my life, emotional about anything, was for me one of those moments that'll stick with me forever. And it's the moments that the fans don't see that you remember the most. I remember in the tunnel after game in Barcelona, I got showered and changed quickly. I just wanted to go and see my wife and my family, and they were on the coach outside, and we went back to the hotel, and it was just mayhem. And nobody went to bed. We got back onto the plane home, and we were on this open-top bus ride around Manchester, and we were coming down Chester Road, and there was probably 1,000, 2,000 people. We got to the bottom of Deansgate, we turned left, and it was breathtaking. It made me emotional, it made me cry. There must have been 500,000 people on Deansgate. And to talk about a goosebump moment, I think if you asked those players at that time what was the favourite moment, it was turning left onto Deansgate, because it took us an hour to get down to Deansgate, because we were finishing at the MEN Arena at the bottom, and literally nobody wanted that day to end.
What were the expectation levels like on the team? Did you expect to walk away with that silverware? And was there a special feeling amongst you? Or, as you've sort of hinted, did it just sort of end up that you won the treble?
Yeah, it did. It was literally day-to-day, game-to-game. The semi-final replay against Arsenal was the turning point. But you look back, I think we played Liverpool in the FA Cup. Ollie scored in the last minute of that game. We were scoring last-minute goals against Inter Milan in the quarter-final. Juventus, we were 2-0 down. So we never thought for 1 minute we were going to win the treble. We just wanted to win the Premier League, or we wanted to win. We never thought we'd win all two. So every game was like, we had this countdown. I think it was Jim Ryan, our assistant manager with Steve McClaren at the time, used to say, the clock's ticking 4 to go, the clock's ticking 3 to go. And we just had this countdown after every game. Let's just win the next one. Let's just win the next one. And when we won the league, the next biggest game was the FA Cup final. We couldn't think about the Champions League final because the FA Cup final was what we'd all dreamt of. And I never forget that Nicky Butt was left out of the FA Cup final because Roy and Scholes, he was suspended, and we couldn't risk him. And he was devastating. Everyone kept coming up to him saying, it's all right, you'll play in the Champions League final. And he was unhappy. He wanted to play in the FA Cup final. And we were just on this roller coaster, and it just we never wanted to stop.
I tell you why I'm enjoying reminiscing about the treble right now, because of everything that's happening with Manchester City, which is really hard to watch. I've been quite lucky that I took a week off Sky just this last week, because I just don't want to be there, quite frankly. And I needed to take some holiday anyway, so I was like, it's perfect timing.
Well, you're sat with a Liverpool fan, so you know this is equal pain.
Do you think Manchester United are in a much healthier position now? We've had those years of transition. You, of course, dipped back in when you were with Ryan Giggs.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've loved that the club, the Glazers, have come back in, and Woodward have made sure that they have brought in players who are part of such a special time and understand the club. And now, of course, we've got Ole, we've got Mike Phelan back in there. Fletcher looks like he's heading back as well as a coach. Do you think that will help Manchester United kick on and try and challenge again on a different level to where they have been for the last few seasons?
I hope so, because I think probably over the last 5 years, what you've seen a team that's probably gone away from the vision and philosophy, what the club's been all about. But what I would say, when you look at Man City and you look at Liverpool and Tottenham, that their club's foundations are really strong. And you'd say that United's are from a financial point of view, but actually stability on the field. That, you know, when you look at those teams, they have a system, they have a style of play, they have tried and trusted methods. I think what United seem to be going at the moment is they're going left, then right, then left, then right, from manager to manager. They actually need to get back to what United do best, and that's playing a certain brand of football that's not just been synonymous with Sir Alex Ferguson, but from the year dot, so Matt Busby, Ron Atkinson. There's a certain brand of football that Man United have to play. And you hope that with Ollie, Mick Phelan, Michael Carrick there, obviously Nicky Butt's in the academy, that United will start getting back to the foundations, what made them. I think it'll take a long time. I really do. I don't think it's a quick fix, this one. But hopefully with those guys in charge and the financial muscle that United still got, that United can be back challenging soon, because it's difficult to watch Man City winning everything. And it's difficult because you think they are a good team and they're miles better than Man United this moment in time.
It's that philosophy, isn't it, which is missing. It's the authenticity from the bottom up. And it'll be really interesting to see how Manchester United start to think about challenging teams like Liverpool, Tottenham, and of course City as well. Because if they don't act and start to ingrain that philosophy, then they are going to get left behind.
Yeah.
So we'll watch that one with interest. I want to take you back, if it's not too painful, to the 1998 World Cup. We're approaching a Women's World Cup now. And of course, I can't help but look at your international career. You come into the women's game as a former England player, and a very respected one at that, and that's, I know, a huge tick in terms of the respect that you hold, not only for fans of the game, but also for the team here as well. You went into that treble season on the back of that disappointment in 1998 when you weren't selected. Did the pain of that experience spur you on the next season? Because it would have been so easy for you to lose your confidence.
I did lose my confidence. I've got to say, it was the biggest learning that I ever had, because for 6 months I was wallowing in self-pity about not going to a World Cup, because World Cup is the pinnacle for anyone. You know, I never forget my father sitting me down and saying, Phil, you've wasted 6 months of your life there, like, moping around. Get up, get on with it, you know, make sure you make the next World Cup. And it took me, I think, 6 months to get my belief and my confidence back in my game, because ultimately when you want to achieve certain things in life, I'd got through to the last 28 of the squad, we'd gone to La Manga, and then to be left out at the last moment was a hammer blow for me. And I was young and I'd put everything into it the 12 months beforehand. And I found it really difficult to to deal with that disappointment. And in life, sometimes you need disappointments to help you improve. And that was a massive learning curve for me. And it's, I think it's helped me in terms of how I've dealt with the players now dealing with World Cup. We named a squad last week, and you know, the 12, 13 girls that I had to leave out, it was real difficult moments, but you wanted to do it in a right way. And you knew that they knew that I could relate to them. I know how they felt. And, you know, so we spoke on the phone and we dealt with it really well, because, you know, it's a hammer blow. But what I said to those girls was, make sure that, you know, deal with the disappointment. You've got 24 hours and then start building yourself back up to get into the next squad.
How important was it for you to have your brother as a teammate, but also take those journeys with you in terms of the fact that you were the first brothers to play together for England since 18 something and something, I mean, a very long time, over 100 years, I think it was. And you were captains of opposing sides. So you hit all these various landmarks with your brother, yet there was this big landmark that you weren't going to hit, that you weren't going to go with him. And, you know, and also similarly to when you left United as well, you have to start to make your journey on your own. What's the emotional connection like with your brother? And did you have to have a word with yourself when you came to those points where you weren't going to be together?
If you think about a normal brother-brother relationship, we are best friends, I've got to say that. And in 98, when I remember coming back from Glenn Hoddle's room, and Gary was actually in with Glenn Hoddle the meeting before me, so he obviously knew that he was going to a World Cup, and he'd obviously been told that I wasn't. So when I came back from Glenn Hoddle's room, he was waiting in my room for me. And I've got to say that me and Gary aren't very, very, you know, lovey-dovey, and we're not huggy, and probably unemotional with each other in terms of that. But he was waiting for me. He was there for me. When I was at United, throughout my career, I've suffered unbelievably through homesickness. Every time I go away, I get homesick. I have done from the age of 12. From 12 to 16, I spent half of my life on the road playing cricket or football. And it's been a massive challenge in my career dealing with homesickness. But having your brother three doors down every single away trip or England camp has meant that you've always had that comfort of having a family member nearby. And even though we've not been, when we've been competing with and against each other, he's just another teammate. Having to share that journey with someone, first and foremost, that you love, and second, with who's your best mate, has made it extra special. And, you know, we're a tight family. And when I left United, I suppose when I left United, it was a time for me to probably grow up away from my brother, away from sort of like being the young class of 92 member, and create my own pathway. But along the way, we own a football club together, a hotel together. We speak probably 3-4 times a day together. But that emotional connection and that friendship has stood us in good stead. We've the 96 FA Cup final I played, he didn't, you know, but it's never affected our relationship. And that's probably been testament to our parents, really.
That homesickness thing you mentioned, I've got some good friends who are twins.
Yeah.
I do think it's a twin. It's that separation thing when you've always had somebody so close.
Yeah.
And I'm talking about Tracy, of course, not Gary. So you do wonder if that comes into it,
I think because I've always been a home bird. And I was speaking to the players the other day, because hopefully we're on a journey of 52 days now. And I said to him, I said, look, there's going to be ups and downs and big challenges. And I said, if anyone sees me walking around the hotel lobby at times, it means I'm homesick. I suffer just like you guys. So me and Tracy are close. I've got to say, I'm not saying we're telepathic in any way, but we have a real special bond where we know how each other's feeling, because we are twins. And you know, but I think because we've been brought up to do everything together, for me, the going away from home part was always really difficult. And because from, say, 11 to 16, playing schoolboy cricket and football, I was away for maybe 4 or 5 months of the year. And I found it really difficult to be always on the road or always away from home, staying in universities and stuff like that. So it's affected me for a long time.
And do you think having a sister who was so close growing up, obviously very close to your wife, Julie, and you've got a daughter, I know you have a son as well, but you've got a daughter who you've also helped through difficult times. Do you think that has helped you, these different relationships that you've had with the women in your life, with the new women in your life now?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I think Tracy's probably been the biggest influence, because when I got this job, people said, you know nothing about women's sport, you know nothing about elite women's athletes. And you know, the 3 or 4 days leading up to the press conferences, I was getting briefed, obviously, off the FA about the questions and stuff. And I was like, you know, please don't talk to me about, I don't know anything about elite or women's sport and what the sacrifices that people have been through. Because literally, my twin sister who's 12 minutes older than me has been through probably more than any other sportsman, through injury, through sacrifices, through lack of financial support and everything. So when I came into camp and I did the press conference and that question was leveled at me early on about, you know, nothing about women's sport, I said, oh, actually, I think you're totally wrong there, because, you know, on a Sunday, we used to play on a Saturday in the Premier League. The Sunday morning we used to get up, me and my brother and my dad, and Tracy and my mum were already on the way down to London or East Grinstead, which I think is four and a half hours away, 3 o'clock in the morning, just to train at netball for England. And so for 5-6 years, then she went to Australia for a year to play netball. Then she came back and was earning absolute pittance just to train for England. And there was 3 sessions a week, but she had to go to here, there and everywhere. And there's me and Gary being lifted and laid on the football side. So we knew full well the sacrifices that half my team has made, and I knew full well the understanding of how to treat elite women athletes. Because, you know, I grew up at the side of a netball court. My mum, we used to go and watch Tracy and my mum play netball. We knew what elite sport was like, and it's made the transition far easier. And like I say, I've not noticed a difference between coaching at Valencia and United to coaching these set of players now. For me, it's been no different, because actually the common goal is they all want to be the same thing. They all want to be successful. They all want to win. They all want to be driven and challenged. And whether you're male or female, I just say I'm coaching a football team. I don't just say I'm coaching a women's football team. It's a football team that have the same values as what, you know, the senior men have at this point, you know?
It's really interesting, because having spoken to Emma Hayes, we've interviewed Emma, we've interviewed Casey Stoney, the Manchester United manager, and they talk about the difference between coaching men and women as that women have a more emotional need. Yeah. And that, for example, as Casey told us, if you tell a guy to go and stand on the pitch and run up and down, he'll do it. If you ask a woman, she'll ask why, and then she'll do it. Have you found any of that? Have you found any differences in the way that you are interacting with your team, or the way that you're having to explain things?
I think the tone of your voice has to be slightly different in certain situations. But what I would say now is that 20 years ago, when we were in the game, there was a different tone to how I was coached 20 years ago by Eric Harrison than what I would teach an academy player now. So if I teach a male academy player, there's a sensitivity, there's an emotional attachment that you do, that there's a tone of your voice that you have to do than if you're teaching a senior player. And what I've noticed with my players is that they want to learn so badly, far more than what the men would probably want to know. You know, if we're playing 4-4-2, why are we playing 4-4-2? What advantage would that give us? How would that help us win the game?
So many questions.
So many questions. But do you know what? I actually think that that's improved me so much as a coach, because I can't just go into a meeting room and say, right, 4-3-3 today, just go out and play, because I have to sort of like coach and manage. But that is actually what coaching and managing is about. If you know, I would have thought that at the elite level, when I was coaching in at United in the first team with David Moyes, the same challenges was there. You couldn't just go out onto the field and say to Robin Van Persie, oh, we're going to do 200 metre runs today. You'd say, well, what help will that give me to become a world-class player? It's no different than saying that to Jodie Taylor or Ellen White. I think what people need to get out of their heads is this massive, big, great divide between male and female football. There's no divide at all for me. No divide whatsoever. There may be physical divides at times, but in terms of the way that you deal with and coach with them, I don't think I've changed one bit.
That's really interesting. I must just drop in quickly that we saw that Emma Hayes had said that girls should play with smaller goals because the size of the goal is built for a man's frame and not for a woman's frame. How do you feel about that? Is that something that you'd agree with? For me, it feels a bit of an odd thing to say, but she's saying that whether you like it or not, there are physical differences, and that's a given. If you start a man and a woman 100 metres in front of a goal, the guy will probably get there first, depending on who the players are.
Yeah.
What do you think about marked differences? A smaller goal, a smaller ball? Is that just stuff that we should put to one side, bin it, and just get on with being equal?
Emma's got great experience. She's got far more experience of me in terms of that. But what I would say is that the knock and effect of from an outset of how would that look? You know, at the moment, there's a massive movement in terms of respect towards female athletes. I'm not just going to say football, netball, cricket, whatever. I think at the moment, I actually have not seen it as a problem. I've not seen it as a problem, because when I first came in, people say, oh, the standard of goalkeeping is pretty low in the women's game. But I actually haven't seen that. I think my goalkeepers have improved so much, because I actually think that the quality of coaching has improved to help them become better, and the opportunities to keep them improving. I think in the past, maybe keepers have just been told to go in the goal, jump up three or four times and get a bit of handling. Now they are physical specimens, they're athletes. So actually, I think with the way that the physicality of the women's game is improving, goalkeeping standards will improve and the need for that smaller goal won't be needed. So, you know, Emma's got great experience. There'll be reasons why she said that. But for me, I think that that would probably set women's football back a little bit in terms of being treated sort of like equal is what everyone wants.
The Offside Rule exclusives.
Canada obviously provided brilliant headlines. There was a lot more press and media coverage on the women's tournament there. It's, in my opinion, going to be doubled, if not tripled, heading into this summer. Do you think that your women are prepared for that? And do you prepare them differently when you look at social media aspect of it, how the press might be picking up on them when they're not used to that? Yeah. We're seeing more headlines that are coming from the WSL, and we certainly cover it a lot more than Sky than when I started out, when there was nothing. And it's, the excitement is growing. We're not even rights holders of any kind, but we're really excited at Sky to be covering it, as well as, of course, the BBC, ITV and everybody else. Yeah. But do you think they're aware of the coverage they're going to be getting?
12 months ago, we started our planning, and we call it red flags. What are going to be the red flags? In injuries was one, you know, injuries to key players. We've already had one to Jordan Nobbs. But actually the media and the impact of the media was probably up there with some of the red flags. And it's because you're thinking about maybe tripling the exposure, which means that they're going to be visible now, which means not just them, the families, the mums, the dads, they're going to be open to any kind of publicity. And what we're experiencing at the moment is that, particularly this last 12 months, is that journalists at the moment are writing nice things about women's football. But what I want to get to the point is where they're actually just writing sort of like what they believe in. If you see a bad game, write this a bad game. It's no different. It's no different. It's not sexist. It's not bad. If it's a bad game, it's a bad game. It's a bad pass, it's a bad pass. But I think what my players will have to deal with, particularly in this World Cup and going forward, is that there will be intrusions in their life, and that might be positive. At the moment, it's positive. Everyone wants Steph, Lucy on their magazine covers, because at the moment, it's fashionable. But do you know what? It could become negative if we're not successful. It could tip over the bridge and they start, you know, interfering with. We've had journalists knock on families' doors, and our players have actually struggled with it. We've had Karen Carney this year had to put up with homophobic death threats. You know, these are happening. They're happening on the men's side of football, but our players are now being exposed, where they're going from 5,000-6,000 followers on Twitter and Instagram to now 20,000-50,000, and all of a sudden it only takes one. It only takes one death threat to Karen Carney or one homophobic question of orientation to somebody just to upset something. So in a tournament, we're going to have to deal with that. We've prepared them. We've advised them. They've decided to go a certain direction with it. And there are safety measures in place to protect families as well, which we've spoke to the families. And, you know, but it's actually, in a way, it's something that we have to deal with because of the rise in the popularity of the game. Sky don't show the football because they have to. They show it because all of a sudden it's becoming popular and people want to know about it. You know, they're not tied somebody's hands behind the back saying you must show the WSL. So we're a victim at the moment of our success, and it's going really well. But we have to be prepared for it getting to that point where players will be exposed to negativity as well. And we all get it. And that is part of life.
What about you and the responsibility on your shoulders? If it doesn't go well in France, you could be billed as the man who ruined women's football in England.
Yeah. I mean. Thanks.
My point is, we've been on this upward trajectory and on and on and on. And it's, you know, particularly blowing up over the last 6 months in the lead up to this World Cup. There is pressure on you, of course there is, because there are eyes on this former England international, former Manchester United player who didn't apply for the job, who got the job and is in his first major tournament on the worldwide stage. The eyes are on you, and foreign countries, when they preview the World Cup, will be talking about you because they will all know you too. How do you handle that?
Well, it's where I want to be. We went to She Believes just before, in end of February, and we went to She Believes, and I've spoke a lot about us wanting to win a World Cup. So at the start, what I said to the girls was, I said, what do we want? And they said, boss, we want to win a World Cup. I said, right, well, we're going to tell the world we're going to win a World Cup. We're going to lift expectations. And every single day we go out there, we've got to produce world-class performances. And to do that, we're going to have to put pressure on ourselves. And we went to She Believes, and it was one of those where we said, right, this is where we want to be. When we finished, when we was in Canada and we was 14th in the world, and Mark Sampson did an unbelievable job, the dream was to become in the top three of the world. Now we're in the top three in the world, let's not start backing off and being worried, because I think there's this English mentality, and I felt it within the FA. Your question is totally fair, because as we're getting nearer, we qualified and we won She Believes, and people were texting me, need to dampen expectations here. We need to just keep our feet on the ground. And I'm like,
friends and stuff?
Friends, colleagues, yeah. Everyone, because there's that fear of going to a World Cup, you've shouted your mouth off, you're going to come on with egg on your face, yeah. You're going to be that person.
And it's a real England fear,
It's an England fear, but yeah. I actually think we're in a different place. Is this that this is where we want to be. My players want to be challenging for a World Cup. I want to be managing at the top level every single game. I want the pressure on me every single minute of every single game. When I sat in front of the players for the first time in La Manga, we spoke about what we wanted. In the past, they've probably never had someone that said, I want to win a World Cup. That takes courage. And we said, look, do we want to win this? And they said, yes, that's what we want. How are we going to do it? And they said, we want you to take us to places that we've never been. And I promised them from day one that I would work them as hard as they've ever worked, and that I would make sure that I would fight for everything possible. And what we've had over the last 12 months is we've had the FA put unbelievable backing to us. They flew us out to Kazakhstan for a game that we won 9-0 on a private jet, never been done before. Business class seats to She Believes. Now, all of a sudden, the players are beginning to believe that everybody's behind
that
them.
That sense
and,
of worth.
And
as
you know
well.
What? You know, maybe 5 years ago, they never had that. They probably had a lot of promises and nobody was there to deliver. Now, I think I've made a lot of promises. I think I've delivered. But more importantly, my organisation, as Sue Campbell, the FA, they've put the money where the mouth is, and they've backed this team more than anything. We're in St. George's Park here, and we've got the best rooms in the house. The senior men are not in the best rooms in the house, because the FA see that, and Gareth see that the World Cup's the priority. So that tells you how far this organisation's come, because you know what, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, you'd walk down this place, there was not a picture of one of my lionesses. Now all of a sudden, they're everywhere. In fact, there's too many pictures of my lioness. No, you know, we need to keep our feet on the ground, and we're where we want to be. We're where I want to be. We won She Believes. We're not embarrassed about celebrating that. We're going to the World Cup as the third ranked best team in the world, which doesn't make us favourites. There's two more better teams than us. But it means that we're going there with a realistic opportunity to lift the World Cup. And I think we should be really proud of that.
So you're going for the win in terms of the World Cup? Or
yeah.
Have you set a target? Is the target the win? And you go for that and you see where you get to? Or is it just...
Look, I think realistically we've got two targets. We want to qualify for the Olympics in 12 months' time, which we've got to finish in the top at three European teams in the tournament. So that's the first one. And then we want to win the World Cup. I think if I started saying now, poor, let's get to a semi-final, let's come home and let's have our open-top bus parade, I think they'd say, boss, please, out the door. You know, I think winning's everything. I think coming second, you might as well come 16th and come second. For me, winning is everything. But what I would say is that I actually think that the way that the women's football is going in England is that we can go to a World Cup, and I still think women's football's winning even if we don't lift that trophy. And that's where me as a manager have got to be slightly detached from all the drama and emotion of, yes, we want to win the World Cup. Because I think the work that we've done over the last 16 months has meant that English women's football is in a brilliant place. And yes, to inspire and to really take off, winning the World Cup would be unbelievable. But I still think that we've got the next 3 or 4 years are going to be really special.
Does this in turn actually help with, yes, the men's team are behind the women's team, women behind the men's, and at all age levels? We've seen how well at youth level things have been going at the FA with England. Do you think the women doing really well will create that little bit of, right, the men like, well, the women are doing, we're going to have to up our game, just as they maybe did for the women's side with last summer with Gareth.
All I would say is that I don't think there's that internal rivalry, but what I would say is that everything that both teams are doing, they're actually helping each other. Yeah. You know, the processes that Gareth went through have been shared with us. The processes that we've been doing have been shared with the pathway teams. Our under-20s finished third in the under-20 World Cup last summer. So that means that when them players mature, and we've had five players with us last week, in 2021, when we got the Euros in England, England will be favourites for that tournament, because these third best team in the world last summer will mean that their maturity will mean so on both sides we've probably got some of the best players in the world at all levels, and that is because of this place that we're in now, St George's Park. It's now beginning to produce world-class teams, and that's because we're all under the same roof. We're all swapping processes, ideas, systems, whatever you want. And we've now gotten a real alignment. And like I say, 3 years ago, you could walk into this building and it was probably just about the senior men. Now it's all pathway teams are represented, all diversities are represented. And I just think it's a brilliant time to be involved in this building.
From the team who bring you the award-winning Totally Football Show comes the imaginatively titled Totally Nations League Show. Join us this June for this special series as we see who, out of England, the Netherlands, Switzerland and host Portugal, will pick up international football's newest trophy. The Totally Nations League Show, totally from Portugal, on Spotify and nowhere else. Subscribe and listen for free now.
Let's get into the World Cup. Main opposition, who are you watching out for in terms of, well, obviously you've got to meet Scotland first.
And it's obviously the huge nation in it.
Yeah, it is.
And that also follows an international game of the men's as well. So you go straight from one to the other as well. So there's going to be plenty of build up to that.
Yeah.
A lot of your Lionesses will be playing against teammates, of course, who are in the Scotland squad as well. And you've got to be careful that they don't spring a surprise.
And they can. Like I said, they've got some really good players. And I think their manager is fantastic, Shelley. They've got players that, you know, I see week in, week out playing in the top teams. You know, you think of the Kim Little at Arsenal's a really good
She's
player.
She's a sensational player.
Do with her in the men's senior team, to be fair.
There's a couple of players in the City team, Caroline Weir, Jen Beattie, really good players. Cuthbert at Chelsea is going to be a superstar. You know, whether she's Scottish or not, is someone that when you go to watch a WSL game, she reminds me of Wayne Rooney. She's just fearless in everything that she does. So we know we're in for a real game. That's the game that is the biggest game for us. But in terms of the World Cup, I think there's probably seven or eight teams that got the quality to win it. We've played 11 out of the top 12 teams, and people say Sweden can win it, Canada can win it. We've played the top four teams in the world. France are going to be really strong. Think of that Lyon side that just beat Barcelona, full of French internationals. And then you've got the USA, best team in the world, got probably the most belief out of any other team. They, you know, when they go on that pitch, they know that they're the best and they act like the best. So we've got unbelievable challenges. It's not going to be easy. Nobody knocks on your door and say, here you are, your World Cup. But we just want to make sure that we beat Scotland.
And results like drawing against the USA at the She Believes Cup as well mean that you have every right to be there. And I think, you know, we have some payback in terms of what happened against Japan in the last World Cup. They, of course, met USA in that final and were trounced by Carly Lloyd and her hat trick. So there's some exciting stuff to come. Your players, let's introduce a few of the personalities to the listeners of this podcast. Who might surprise us out of your squad at the World Cup? If there's a player that we're maybe not talking much about, or someone who you think might be a bit underrated in terms of the public's view, who should we be watching out for?
I suppose in terms of improvement this year, Nikita Paris has gone on to the world-class level stage. Kira Walsh has been sensational, really. From day one, I knew she was a player, but this year she's improved so much. Georgia Stanway is a little kid that could be a star.
Do you know, I was reading about Georgia that she has a lifelong ambition to become a policeman after she retires.
Yeah, I mean,
does that tell us?
The first squad that I ever named was for the She Believes 2 years ago, and I went to watch Man City probably 4 or 5 days before it. Saw this little kid play. Saw two players play, Abby McManus and Georgia Stanway. And Abby McManus was selecting the team. And I selected Abby because she made one pass in the game that I thought that'll do for me. So I wrote her name down, got to play. And then this little kid just kept buzzing around. She's young, 18. She's got big character. We had probably five or six pullouts. And I remember saying to my staff, got to pick Georgia Stanway. And they were saying, oh, she's too young. We've got to pick the Georgia Stanway. So we picked her. She came. And instead of having singing initiations on camp, what we do, we tell the girls to tell us about the stories and the background and the journeys. So they stand up and it's really powerful. And she told us how she drove from Cumbria to Blackburn 3-4 times a week. Her dad drove her down there. And I don't know if you saw a picture on Twitter a couple of weeks ago when she queued for an hour and a half to have a picture done with Steph Orton, who was at the game. And it's fun. And then, you know, 4 or 5 years later, she's in an FA Cup final, the same pitch with Steph Orton. That's what dreams are made of. Abby McManus stood up and said her dream was to play for England, but she never thought she was good enough. And as she's telling this story, half the room's crying because it means so much. And there's a great humility about these kids. So I said Georgia Stanway could be one of those surprises. Nikita Paris has obviously had a great season and goal scoring. I'm lucky. I've got some really good players.
And what do players like Jill Scott and Karen Carney add to the mix? Very experienced.
The most important, you think of Carney and Scott, over 250 caps between them. I said to Jill yesterday that, you're not retiring. You can play. She can play till she was 40. Her influence around the team for Carney and Scott is unbelievable. They're the ones that keep people on the ground when they're getting carried away. We have 11 players going to this tournament that's never been to a World Cup. So the experienced ones are going to have to play their part. And what we do with Karen and Jill, they tell their stories about when they went to, I think it's fourth World Cup for Jill Scott. She's been to World Cups and not played. She's been to World Cups and been injured. She's been to World Cups and been disappointed. She's passed on all that experience. But ultimately, they are good enough to be in the team and in the squad still. That's the most important thing, and that's what they're judged on. And they've been, 10 years ago, they've turned up to a training session with no balls, no referee, on the worst pitches in the world, no kit, everyone in different coloured kit. So they are actually now, they're the ones that are now fought so hard for the next generation. And I think that this World Cup and this generation now need to be so thankful for those players, Hope Powells, Mo Marleys and Mark Sampsons, these old players that and coaches that fought so hard to get to this point today where actually I took this job and the surroundings, Kira Walsh, Georgia Stanwyck, they don't know any different than this. But that's because these great players like the Pharrell Williamses fought like mad for moments so they could give these young kids better now. And we remind them of that. And Karen and Jill and Steph and Lucy, who have been through that old-fashioned where they had to fight for everything, have been through that and struggled through that, now need to make sure that they keep these young girls on their feet.
Before the last World Cup, Fran was famously called the mini Messi. Yeah. And I'm not sure about that whole comparing women to men. It's not a personal favourite of mine. But she's matured, obviously, so much in the last 4 years. She was brilliant at the last World Cup, and we saw this, raw talent developing and creating chances and not being phased on the big stage. What kind of player is Fran within your setup? How's her maturing over these last 4 years contributed to your team?
When you see her on the pitch, you think big personality, big character. Off the pitch, she's really quiet, doesn't really like to be mithered with. You go and see if she's okay. She says, "I'm okay, boss, leave me alone." She doesn't like all the razzmatazz, the fluff we call it. She just wants to play football. But you just got to make sure that you look after your special players. And she is one of our special players. When you talk about winning World Cups, you need some special players in your team. And she's one of those that's got that gold dust, the ability to turn the pass to Nikita Paris in the American game in 30,000 people under pressure, just whipped it over the top. She's got that ability. What we need to do with Fran is just to make sure that we protect her, give her the minutes that she needs, and just let her enjoy her football. She's a number 10, she's a centre forward. They don't need telling what to do. They just need the platform, the environment to be good for them to go and express themselves.
And what about the role that your captain's obviously going to have to play, standing up to that challenge and really rising to the occasion?
Yeah, she's a brilliant captain. She's a brilliant person. She's probably had her best and worst 12 months of her life. Without going into the detail, people know what she's going through in obviously her personal life. But in terms of what she's achieved on the pitch, she's had her best ever season. She's respected. She leads by example. She never misses a training session. She wants to play in every minute of every game. And her standards are unbelievable. You're thinking about somebody that's never late, always dresses the same, always makes sure that all the players are okay. She's a tremendous captain. We have four captains. We have Steph, we have Lucy, Carly Telford, and we have Jordan Nobbs. Jordan Nobbs isn't with us. She did a cruciate. Them four really drive the standards within the team.
Steph Horton, we're obviously talking about. I didn't mention her in the question. I thought it was a bit obvious, that one. Just a final one from me about throughout the tournament, throughout your career, you've obviously got your brother Gary, who you say you speak to at least three times a day. You've got your sister you can call upon as well. Are there other people in football who you would go to for bits of advice, or just someone just to sound you out of an idea, or just to call up, just to take your mind off other things?
No, I don't. I obviously read and listen a lot. I always have done, and there are people out there that I can bounce ideas off. But I always think that, you know, when I took this job, I only probably spoke to two people, and that was my sister and my wife. I like to follow my gut feeling. I like to go out there and think, well, do you know what? I'm not going to be influenced by anyone. I'm gonna live by the sword, die by the sword, and gonna do it my way. And I've got confidence in myself that I've got the ability to do that. Along the way, you get support, brilliant support from people. And I've played with the best managers in the world who have given me unbelievable support and still to this day influence me. But when it comes to sort of like big decisions in my life, I don't like to ask too many people. I like to be my own person. I like to lead myself. And I like to look in the mirror at the end of the day and say, well, you know what, you followed your gut. It was the right thing. And you know what, if we win, we win. And if we lose, I did it my way. That's a song, that, isn't it?
Finishing off nicely. Where could this go on to? So let's say you have a successful World Cup and a stint as the England women's manager, and then you decide it's time for a change. You could be, by my calculations, the first manager in the women's game to go on and manage a men's team, which is quite a freaky thing when you think about it, isn't it? The first ever manager of a women's side to go on. Is that something that you are at all thinking about, where this goes on from here? Or is it now the focus on the women's game, and how long-term is that for you?
Well, do you know what? The focus is only on the women's game. I like to look at it as that I was the first probably Premier League coach ever to go into the women's game, rather than, you know, going back the other way, because I've done the other thing, and I've got to say at the moment I'm enjoying this better than the other thing. So I can't see beyond this job. I really can't. I think this is a massive job. I think when I sat down with the people that I spoke to about this job, I thought, this is a great time to be getting involved in women's sport. I think, you know, you look at the volatility of men's football, wasn't something that I really enjoyed. I lost my job twice at times when I was really enjoying it and thought I was doing okay. But what I thought about my job here was that I can make a massive difference, and I can, and when we talk about the goals is to produce the best women's sports team of all time, and to make sure that, you know, people talk about the Lions, I want people to talk about the Lionesses as one of the best sports teams, you know, that have won medals, that have won Olympics, that have created a legacy for sport, not just for female sport. So I think that's what I want to build with this set of Lionesses, and we speak all the time, and I always say to the team, and I say to my staff, don't just think about winning. Think about things that are bigger than winning. Think about the legacy that we're going to provide. And, you know, I want people coming, visiting the Lionesses, to look at our methods, to look at our training standards, to look at our processes. That's what we want, because, you know, I've studied AC Milan, I've studied Bielsa, I've studied the Lions, and you look at what they do. The All Blacks are a brilliant example of a team that's got a culture that's left a legacy in sport, never mind just in rugby. So I want the Lionesses to eventually get to that kind of level where people are coming to us and seeing what we're doing with a group of the most unbelievable, I'd say, human beings that I've ever worked with. When I took this job, you think of footballers in a certain way. And I came in and said, I'm going to inspire every day. And we met up for camp today, and they bounce into camp and they've got smiles on their faces, and they ask me, you know, if you say to stop, no, we want to do more. Today was a day off. Boss, can we go in the gym? Boss, can I go out on the training field? Boss, what can we do more to help us win? And you're inspired by the players that you're actually managing. So I'm in the best place in the world. I'm an England manager, senior manager, and I think I've got the best job in the world at this moment in time.
Phil Neville, we look forward to seeing that legacy play out with brilliant success. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. Merci beaucoup.
Merci beaucoup.
There you go. Let's get working on the French, eh?
The Offside Rule is a Muddy Knees Media production. For sales and advertising, email sales@muddyneesmedia.com.